Hello and welcome to the Security DNA podcast produced by SecurityInfoWatch.com. I'm John Doberstein, managing editor of Security InfoWatch and producer of this podcast. The editors here at Security InfoWatch utilize this podcast to provide detailed, actionable information of value to security professionals. This will include industry news, trends and analysis, technology solutions, policy risk analysis, and management. For this episode, I have with me my colleague, Steve Lasky, who is the editorial director for the security group at Endeavor Business Media. Steve will be talking today with Stephen Bernard. Stephen is a senior security advisor for International SOS, a firm that works with global organizations to assess the risks associated with every working environment, from a corporate office to a remote oil rig. They design robust and customized preventative programs to protect employees and staff. When prevention isn't possible, they offer the company and its workforce access to its 24/7 assistance service. Before joining International SOS, Stephen served as executive vice president at Sony Pictures Entertainment, where he spent 16 years before retiring in 2018. After a successful career at Sony, he launched Bernard Global and saw global demand for his services grow rapidly. His extensive experience includes the protection of personnel, content, and data, and properties in over 50 countries and 6 continents. Before his duties with Sony, he served in key leadership roles in technology, energy, and food, including stints at Apple, Campbell Soup, Herbalife, U.S. Department of State, Tel Aviv University, USC, and with law enforcement and the FBI. Steve was also awarded the Bronze Star, among other commendations, for his service during the Vietnam War. Steve holds degrees in criminal justice and psychology. He is a graduate of the FBI National Academy at Quantico, and he's lived overseas for 7 years and traveled to over 50 countries. Steve remains engaged with the law enforcement community, including the U.S. Department of State, academia, the International Security Management Association, the Domestic Security Advisory Council for the FBI, and the Overseas Security Advisory Council, as well as InfraGuard and ACES International. And with that, let's turn it over to Steve.
Thanks, John. Much appreciated. Stephen, it's great to see you again, and it's great to have you on Security DNA.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for thinking of me.
Oh, you're always definitely lurking in the background, since I feel like I've been stalking you for the last 30 years of your professional career that was non-law enforcement and military. And, you know, I want to start with you had a well-rounded career in both the physical management and then now in the cyber side as well. And, you know, I think we'll all agree that cyber resilience is now a critical component for any enterprise resilience framework that a company is going to put together. So you were thrown in perhaps one of the most publicized and most destructive nation-state cyber attacks in the history of cybersecurity when you were leading the global protection team at Sony Pictures. So let me set the stage a little bit for the audience, and then I'll have you provide your insights regarding this event and kind of shine a light on what it was like from your perspective inside the cyclone, so to speak. So on November 24th, 2014, a hacker group identifying itself as the Guardians of Peace leaked a release of confidential data for Sony Pictures Entertainment. The data included personal information about Sony Pictures employees and their families, emails between employees, information about executive salaries at the company, copies of then unreleased Sony films, plans for future Sony films, scripts for certain films, and just a myriad of other information. The hackers also employed a variant of the Shamoon wiper malware to erase Sony computer infrastructure, which was extremely destructive. But this is kind of the weird part for me. During the hack, the group demanded that Sony withdraw its then upcoming film, The Interview, starring James Franco as a reporter and Seth Rogen as a producer, who were hired by the U.S. State Department in South Korea governments to set up an interview with the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un as part of an assassination plot for him. And the group threatened terrorist attacks at cinema screenings around the world that were going to stalk the film. After many major U.S. theater chains opted not to screen the movie, the interview in response to these threats, Sony chose to cancel release and the formal premiere in mainstream theaters and opted to skip directly to the download digital releases. And thank God for us, because it was a horrible movie. The U.S. Intelligence officials, after evaluating the software techniques and network sources used in the hack, concluded that the attack was sponsored by the government of North Korea, which, of course, they denied all responsibility. However, to this day, some independent cybersecurity experts doubt the involvement of North Korea. So tell us about the Sony hack, how you and your team dealt with it, and what were the eventual impacts and ramifications to your organization, and how do you think this attack changed how enterprise organizations now view cybersecurity vulnerabilities?
Let me start with, John, in listening to you describe me, I realize I'm a long ways away from what you call retirement. I'm still pretty active, and I'm enjoying it. So on the dialogue around what happened on Thanksgiving week of 2014. Let me preface it by saying my job at the time was Executive Vice President of Global Protection Services for Sony Pictures Entertainment, and we did a lot of work for all the rest of Sony, because they really didn't have one of us. I also had a converged model, which I think is going to become very important as we begin the dialogue on this. Converged model, including all of SEHS, security, environmental, health, safety, medical, fire, at our own fire department, medical services. We had a clinic that had 8,000 walk-ins a year. And we did medical services, production safety on all the productions around the world as well. And we covered movie premieres and what have you. So there was a lot that we did. I had the CISO function reporting to me. I had global investigations. We had three forensic labs, one in Hong Kong, one in London, one in LA, which fortunately were all wired offline, which again became a very critical thing for us. I also had BCP responsibilities and resilience and response. We did a lot of incident management of all types. And so we tested. We had plans that were not sitting on a shelf somewhere. We were pretty familiar with them. However, I will say that we never planned for a destructive cyber nation state attack. So we had to ramp up very quickly. So I think one of the things that was important about the day that they launched, and by the way, they'd been in there about 6 months through a phishing attack. The day they launched was Thanksgiving week. And what you look at when you kind of do the history on cyber attacks and other major incidents is you typically see them happening at times of holidays when people are not as readily available. And so I was in the office at 7 a.m. that morning, but my CISO was on his way to Idaho. Wow. And other people that in senior leadership roles were out for the week.
Do you think that was pre-planned? I mean, you think they did it on holiday break?
I think that was a part of it. Yeah. Good strategy on their part.
Right.
I'll just stop there a moment and say that I think when we do our planning nowadays, what we need to really think about is not only who's in charge, who are the decision makers, but when they're not available, who's in charge and who's the decision maker.
Right.
So, you know, tier it, and create escalations because decisions have to be made. So what happened was a lady who worked for me walked in my office at 7 a.m. I had not turned my computer on yet, showed me her screen on her phone. She'd taken a picture of her, what happened when she turned her computer on. And it was the Red Devil, Guardians of Peace, with the beheading of our two co-chairmen. And just in other words, their heads on an image. And a bunch of URL links that that the threat referenced. So we soon realized that the way that this is going to destroy our data, and you said it, it was the Shamoon wiper malware, right, which means when you connect to the internet, anything on your hard drive is going to go bye-bye, right, quickly. So we had to get the word out to thousands of people worldwide, do not turn your devices on. However, in some time zones, it was too late. They'd already done it. Or it was the middle of the night. So another thing I think that I wanted to hit on is really, really important is, do you have the ability to connect and communicate with your people worldwide, wherever you operate, whenever you operate? Is that a part of your contingency plans? Because getting the message out early is critical. So for us, we because it was early in the morning, we had about 3,500 people around the studio in LA, Culver City. We made copies. And we took an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper and said, do not turn your computer on. Call security. And we did desk drops at all 3,500 locations. So I think we saved a lot of our data in doing that. Secondly, we had to determine source and purpose. So the links I mentioned that were on the Guardians of Peace warning, none of them worked. I mean, there was no way to communicate with the bad guys.
Were they dead links, or were they?
They were made up. They were fictitious. Okay. So we suspected it might be them because right. we'd actually in the spring of the year, two letters were received from the DPRK, North Korea, and one went to the UN Secretary, and the other one went to the President of the United States. And they said, if Sony Pictures releases this film, we consider it an act of war. Wow. That's pretty powerful.
Yeah.
Whatever that means. So when something like this happens, you consider the magnitude of it. And then the question becomes, what do you do about it? How do you mitigate, sustain, prevent, salvage, communicate, you know, all these things change moment by the moment. And part of our program was that we had done about 150 business impact analysis, BIAs. So our heads of functional areas had in hand plans that they had participated in that gave them a platform to operate off of and in something like this. That was great. We also mustered our crisis team as soon as we could. And then we stood that up for several months, not days or weeks. And we did a lot through that, that group of people who sacrificed a hell of a lot. But the next thing was, even though I had a robust team, if we're taking on a nation state that's bent on not only destroying us, but damaging our image and our brand and our reputation and creating a chill, if you will, we need help. So I had a conversation very early that morning with the leadership, and I strongly encouraged us to engage the FBI. And the reason was partly the FBI's legal attaché program, which now operates in about 90 embassies and consulates around the world. And it's not because they have any more authority than we would have, in essence. But what they have is relationships with government and law enforcement. And that became critical for us. That was amazing. But we had a little bit of a debate, and a lot of your listeners today are going to have the same debate, and that is, oh, we're going to lose privilege, legal privilege, and everything's going to be discoverable, and oh my God, you know, that can't
be. That's part of the argument, Stephen, right there, is that, you know, up until big events like this, most companies found it more advantageous to kind of sweep these attacks under the rug and not make them public because they feared, you know, repercussions, or they feared brand damage, or things like that. So, I mean, that had to be a difficult decision for your team and management.
Well, it wasn't difficult for me, but it was for others. And the reason right, it wasn't right. for me is because I had built these relationships over sure. many, many years. Right, very right. active in DSAC, graduate of the FBI National Academy. In fact, I had been to the DSEA with the assistant director of the FBI in the LA office.
Right.
And we knew each other well. And so after a little encouragement and a comment about, you know, and one of the comments was, if we do this, we're going to lose control. And my comment was, we've already lost control. Mm-hmm. So, and I didn't know, I mean, we also brought in Mandiant, which is now FireEye, which is right. Google. Right. And that was a good choice on our part because they stepped up. They could do things we couldn't do. Some of their guys had clearances. And so the partnership between my team, Mandiant, the FBI, the DOJ, EY, and a few others was all the difference. And we had, so when you're in a serious situation, what I always recommend is bring in the Army. You can always send a few of them home.
Sure.
But overcompensate, overstaff. And the other reason for that is there are things that are going to be happening that your people may not be familiar with. And you have to really manage burnout. Burnout is a serious factor, and it certainly was for us.
Right.
And so what they say is that, you know, managing a crisis of that magnitude is not for everybody, and that's absolutely right. However, I had other people that stepped up and brought cots in their office and worked 20 hours a day. And we did barbecues, and we fed our Army, and, you know, we took care of people because the studio was closed. Everything was closed. There is no email. There is no digital communication. Our products that are digitized aren't going anywhere, right? Because nobody trusts our networks.
How long was Sony down from a business?
I'm going to say, well, you got to define down. But for the most part, I would say 2.5-3 months.
Goodness.
So who could run their business for 2.5 or 3 months?
Yeah.
And I think it's worthy of mention. Once people realize, oh, sorry, let me finish this. So yeah. The other decision that was the critical decision on day one, if we unplug ourselves worldwide and we go dark, there's no more damage. The only damage really is how do we communicate with each other? And one more big deal, the continuity of your business. How does your business continue? How do people make payroll? I mean, all these things that you just assume are natural, except all of a sudden you're dark. So we figured all that out, and I can talk more about that, but that was a big deal. So we went dark, and we had people sitting around saying, I can't use my computer. That's my job. What do you want me to do? Go home? And the answer is no. Actually, we're going to run the business like we used to before you had a computer. Pen and paper. The other thing that we did, though, about, I don't know, 2-3 weeks into it, we were purging our BlackBerry program, BlackBerry devices.
Right.
And they were all sitting in boxes. So we had shifted to a different model. BlackBerries have their own servers, which meant that we could reestablish our communications. We didn't have enough BlackBerries, but we had quite a few. And so that's how we began to find a way to communicate, to keep things going night and day. And that helped a lot. And then, as I said, I think with the Bureau that day, I had 6 cyber agents in my office. One of them, because you talked about attribution, Right. One of them was a South Korean who had been to Seoul and helped them when Dark Seoul happened, which was the attack against the banks and the ATMs. Within a matter of hours, he said, that's the same malware we found in South Korea.
So basically that was your smoking gun right there.
That was one of them. Yep, that was a big one. And so we were able to do a lot of things with the Bureau and the DOJ to work through what happened, how it happened, when it happened, who was responsible even. So remember, November 24th is the day they launched.
Right.
On December 19th, Director Comey of the FBI and the President of the United States, Obama, jointly made attribution to North Korea. Unprecedented. Right. That never would have happened had we not, called for their help. So when people debate whether you should summon law enforcement, the thing I'd say about it is get the right partner, right, that has the right capabilities to help you. But have these conversations in advance. For example, this is 10 years later. So what the Bureau does today with various types of cases is different than they did before. There may be DHS, Secret Service, or even local law enforcement that will handle certain types of incidents. Everybody's gotten a little better at it. So you've got to figure out who you're going to call and what is the response going to be and what are they going to expect from you, and the issue of legal privilege. It's still important. But one of the things for us on that decision on day one was we don't want to be reading about ourselves in a negative way in the paper every day. And so here's another benefit, unintended consequence. By bringing in the Bureau, we were not allowed, and we didn't want to, but we were not allowed to comment. And we had the world media on us 24/7 for over a month, hottest story in the world. And our comment was, this is a criminal investigation. It's being handled by the FBI and the DOJ. Here's their phone number.
One of the points, though, you make, which is interesting, is you had the advantage of having these relationships with law enforcement and federal agencies that, probably most security directors in your position would not have. So having a pre-ordained policy and infrastructure of, you're basically a law enforcement and federal agency phone tree is very important. So, I mean, I find that very interesting.
Well, in your larger companies today, most of them have CSO functions.
Correct. Right.
And now the FBI has developed DSAC, the Domestic Security Alliance Council. Right. We are up to almost 700 members.
Wow. Okay.
And so it's a very different day than it was then. And it's a good point you made. Right. You can do this not only through the Bureau, but through DHS, Secret Service, other law enforcement agencies. LAPD has got a great cyber team, LA Sheriff's Office as well. So I'm just giving you a couple of examples.
Sure.
But also companies like FireEye have continued to really improve in their offerings and their capabilities, and they're candid about it. So I think it is a different day, but I'll go to the small and medium-sized businesses, to your point, where maybe they don't have any relations built. It doesn't mean that their CIO or one of the CISO can't join InfraGuard,
right,
and can't develop their own relationships and networks and become much more active and participative. And again, you've got to make it a part of your contingency plan. Who are you going to call? It's critical. It's a matter of survivability. That's what I teach today when I talk about this, is are you going to survive it? And so what the question really is, are you prepared? Have, and do you, a great example bridge collapse, right, in Baltimore. I don't know what kind of plans they had, but when that vessel realized they'd lost power and they were going to hit a pylon, they called Mayday. Mayday call came at 1:26 a.m. By 1:29 a.m., they had closed off access to the bridge on both ends. In 3 minutes, in the middle of the night, how did they do that? I'll bet you that I don't know that that was a part of their planning, but when you think about catastrophes and worst case scenarios, what I find in a lot of people I talk with that want to build a program and then test it is, and I've had CEOs on down say this to me, let's test it, but don't make it too bad or too difficult because we don't want to embarrass anybody. And I said, then you don't want to learn. My response is, I won't let anybody go down a rabbit hole. This is not about embarrassing people. This is about learning and preparedness. And bad things can happen, really bad things can happen at the time you least expect it. So I think it's really, really important for your listeners to think differently about that. You know, make it tough, test it more regularly, right. Keep it fresh, and be aware of what the hell's going on in the world.
Right. You know, that's a great segue to, you know, the next topic. You know, we've got a lot of crucial events coming up around the globe right now, and a lot of things happening, both that are going to affect cyber, physical security, and business continuity for a lot of global enterprises. We've got, you know, the general elections in the U.S. We've got elections around the world. We just had a quote-unquote election in Russia. We've got ongoing conflicts in the Middle East and the Ukraine and on the continent of Africa. We've got the rising specter of potential terrorist attacks at the Olympics in Paris this summer. We've got, you know, issues in the southern border with potential terrorist cells coming into the states and maybe enhancing the risk of attacks here. But we've also got the risk of domestic terror attacks in the U.S. because of the election. So, you know, what do you see as the biggest threats coming up over the next 12 months globally, if I'm a global CSO? And as a company, how am I going to assess those risks and ensure that I've got a plan to address them?
You just kind of pressed one of my big buttons.
I know.
let me give you just a quick background and I'll lead up to answering your question.
Yep.
In 2022, the World Economic Forum convened in the winter, right, and the buzzword was polycrisis. It was actually permacrisis, which then became polycrisis. Permacrisis actually is a word now in the Collins Dictionary. It never was. And what it implies is a constant state of crisis. What polycrisis means is a constant state of crises,
right,
more than one. So what was the outcome of that as well is they put out a document. It was Insight 2023 report that was about 60 pages long. So when you think about all the stuff that's going on out there and may be coming, a lot of it is mentioned, but it's mentioned in the form of climate change and impacts on business and people, mental health crises. How are we, you know, now that we're coming back to work or even in the remote work environment, people are struggling more than ever with confusion, with poverty, with illness, with all kinds of things, with the stigma that even though I'm not doing very well, I don't want to tell my boss because I don't want to lose my job, or I do tell my boss, but they're not prepared for how to handle it.
Correct.
Right. So then the word gets out in the organization that you can't talk about the problems you're having. And then what? So, and then you mentioned elections, the divided country that we live in today, and many other countries that are divided or oppressed by elections, 60 of them worldwide this year. And I can go on and on. The list is kind of staggering. The insider threat, the fact that we are social media, right? The abuse of social media, misinformation, disinformation, malign nation states. And nation states are becoming much more active overtly and covertly. So there are certain countries that we know of that have very, very active ransomware gangs that are professionals that make millions of dollars, that give a little to their host nation where they live and operate with impunity. And we can't extradite them, even though we know who they are. Although recently Interpol did a really good job in taking down a big one, but it's very difficult. So you start to get the picture of what it is. So to me, it's no one crisis. It's the combination of all of this. And I want to go a step further and tell you, I recently spoke with, because I've been doing some programs on this. I did one for DSAC, but I spoke with a company that is very large, about 100,000 employees worldwide. And we're talking about polycrisis and what are you doing about it? And what they said is that they started to feel really being overwhelmed by it. Because this comes in this door and this comes in that door, and who's supposed to handle it? Who has the expertise? What do you do about it? And it comes to this idea, which I just love this. So what, comma, now what? So the so what is, why do I care? And the now what am I going to do about it? Right? So now you got my attention. What am I going to do about it? And what they found was they were all over the board with who was dealing with what. And now they've organized it. So, and they have smaller teams that will do the research quickly and analyze the potential for impact and risk and damage. And then they'll figure out where to channel that, and then they'll deal with it. Or they won't deal with it. They'll park it. That doesn't mean it goes away. Means they pay less attention to it because they're busy. And I'll give you the example that you gave me. Last year, there were over 400 of these in that company that in some way impacted them or their people. And 100 of them, they really dealt with. Think about that. 100 crises in 1 year in one company that in some way really affected them to the point that they mustered a team to deal with it. I offer this, that most companies have not thought this way. They're not ready for this. And when their day comes, you know, it's a hope and a prayer or a wing and a prayer. Well, and that doesn't, I mean, that's great, but good luck.
Yeah, Steve, it begs the question too, that, you know, there's a whole new model of assessing risk at companies now that you've got to understand, not only what your risk is, but, you know, when does it reach a level of criticality that you have to deal with it, as you just said, and then who in the food chain in your company is assigned that risk, and what level of risk are they able to shoulder and deal with on their own before involving more people. So kind of speak to that, because that's an interesting kind of not a new concept, but it's an interesting concept on the assignment and delegation of risk in a company.
Yeah, I think that you just have to be really thoughtful about it. You have to be pragmatic and realize it's happening and that it will affect you. I mean, people say, we're not really a global company. We just kind of do our stuff in the US. Mm-hmm. And I say, okay, is your business digitized? Yes. You're a global company.
Sure.
Your company's at risk. You want to admit it or not, or think that way? Sorry, you are. What does that mean? You're maybe not as affected as other companies that truly are global in what they do, but you're within reach. You know, I go back to the attack that we had at Sony. So Sony Pictures, LA, you know, theaters all over the U.S. didn't want to release the film because they might have a 9/11 attack. Okay, we found a way to release it on Christmas Eve digitally. And we didn't do it for the money. We did it for the principle.
Right.
But guess what? Sony's parent company is in Tokyo within missile range of you-know-who. So you got to think differently about this, that if you're going to play in the digital space, you have risks that you may not have imagined. And you may have enemies that weren't there yesterday, but they're there today because of something you said or did. So I think another thing that we really have to pay attention to is your social media usage policy. It's okay. You want to be on social media? Go have fun. But when you bring the company that you work for into it, that can be a big issue. Unintended, again, more often than not. But you gotta really stop and rethink the business model and what exposes you. Does that help?
Yeah, and it's to me, I'm like you, it concerns me too that we seem as a country to be moving more and more towards this isolationist type stance of you know some parties are and to me that's extremely dangerous for the business environment because as you said. You know, we're not an island anymore. And this is not the 1940s. Everything's connected. And if you're digitized, as you say, you've got vulnerabilities around the world. If you're a third party vendor, if you're working with a larger global company, you're inherently at risk because you're still on their food chain. So, you know, nobody's an island, whether you're a business or a country when it comes to security.
Let me, you hit on something really important and I don't want to let it go. So again, maybe we're just a U.S. company, right, in our mind, but are you dependent on the supply chain, on third parties, on international manufacturers or whoever? Are you dependent on them to feed your business? Probably so. But here's the deal. You may do the best job you can think of in the way of protecting your data and your networks and your systems and your access and all that stuff. That's really, really great. But the guy that you let plug into you who hasn't done the same, who's more vulnerable, and you look at SolarWinds as an example. Oh my gosh. It didn't matter how good you were because you were plugged in where you shouldn't have been. Well, I'm not going to say that. You had to be. However,
you didn't do your due diligence or vet your other vendors.
Yeah. I mean, and the other thing we do is we say, you know, we've got a robust digital security program and blah, blah, blah. And we do multi-factor authentication and, you know, we do patching immediately and blah, blah, blah. And we expect you to do the same or you can't do business with us. And then what happens? We go back to business. Who audits that? Who validates that those that you trusted to allow to plug into you are doing something similar? And if they have a moment where they've been breached, do they immediately notify you? And I'll give you an example of what United Healthcare is dealing with right now. I have a friend in a major healthcare provider company who, the moment they heard that this was happening, unplugged from them. They had to go through a whole different process of processing claims and payments and what have you. But they were smart enough to know that this could migrate, right? This virus. And we don't think that way today. And so we've really got to get more serious about this because the kinetic effect, if you will, or systemic effect goes both ways.
I tell you, I couldn't think of a better way to end our conversation. Great, great point and a great stepping off place. Stephen, it was great to talk with you, catching up with you again. Every time you have a conversation with me, it just sort of expands, you know, my understanding of not only the global implications of the world we're playing in, but just, you know, what folks like you were bringing to the table. So I really appreciate it. Hopefully I'll see you down the road here. And John, I'm going to throw it back to you.
Stephen, thanks for joining our podcast and providing your insights into enterprise security on both the cyber and physical security sides of the house. Just a reminder to our audience, this podcast is for you, so you can stay informed about trends in the security industry anytime, anywhere. To access our podcast lineup, go to podbean.com and search for the Security DNA. You can also find our podcasts in our Security Frontline, Integrator Newswire, and Security Week e-newsletters. Of course, we'd love to get some feedback from you, our listeners, about topics you're interested in. If you have a suggestion, send an email to slasky, S-L-A-S-K-Y, at securityinfowatch.com. This episode of the Security DNA podcast was recorded and produced by John Dauberstein, Managing Editor of Security Infowatch. For Steve Lasky, Stephen Barnard, and everyone here at Security Infowatch, thanks for listening and stay safe out there wherever you may be.